Now, you've brought a little passage to read from that part of the book.
Yes, and I want to read it because the first chapter is called 68. And my feeling about what's happening now in the United States is welcome back to 1968 with the absurdity, the outrage, and the social turmoil. So actually, I feel quite at home in these days because it reminds me of 1968.
I know if you live long enough, it all comes back.
It all comes back to you, both the good and the bad. And I'm going to read a couple of short sections, one of which is after the doctor has called the coroner and I'm about to be taken away. And I've called my girlfriend in St. Petersburg to wire me the money to get out of the state. What a horror show, I'd gasp, shaking my shaggy head in disbelief. My mother's creepy doctor is going to commit me to the loony bin. I need to get out of the state fast. Please wire me $25 care of the downtown office of American Express so I can take the bus back to St. Petersburg, where I was going to college. It would take several hours for the wire to go through, so I decided to stop by my grandparents' house on South Clark Street to collect my manuscripts and a change of clothes. When I arrived, Mamère, my mother's mother, was sitting in her cane-back rocking chair in the parlor reading the Times-Picayune. "What are your plans for New Year's Eve?" she asks. "Do you want an artichoke?" "Pas pour les matinons," I shot back in the kitchen French she was teaching me. Adrenaline pumping, I sped downstairs into the cold, dank basement, threw my papers into the vinyl valise with which I'd traveled home, and then raced out of the side door into the narrow alley between the raised shotgun houses. Hands resting on their holstered guns, two policemen were walking up the alley as I was scurrying down it, clutching to my stomach the valise filled with poem manuscripts. "You must be Jimmy," one of the cops drawled in a syrupy tone. "Come with us, young fella, and everything will be all right." "Where are you taking me?" In a panic, I glanced up and down the alley. "They say you've been sick and need to go to the hospital." The cop grabbed me by the elbow and yanked. They dragged me out of the alley and toward the squad car parked in front of the house. Mamère was standing on the front porch, wringing her hands around a dish towel, tears streaming down her face. She caught my eye as they were shoving me into the back seat of the car. I felt so sorry for her, having to witness this. After his death, her teenage son Jimmy's mangled bicycle had been delivered home in a police car. Now she must think his namesake was a common criminal. "Here you're a college boy now," said one of the cops, turning around to face me, a smarmy smile pasted on his luncheon meat face. "Where you go to high school, son?" "Ben Franklin," I said, bracing for the response. Franklin was the nerdy college preparatory public high school popularly associated with Jews, sissies, and civil rights activists. "Figures," the cop said, swinging his big belly around. We drove without speaking until we reached the looming iron gates of St. Vincent de Paul Hospital, where orderlies rushed out to escort me to the third floor, the acute ward called Rosary 3, still clutching the vinyl valise of poems to my stomach. In some memories of this moment, one that sliced my life like no other into a clear before and after, the cops turned on their siren and flashing red lights as we sped through the violet twilight of the last day of 1967. During those final moments of childhood, I studied the menacing city of my birth through the grimy squad car window, saying goodbye to the boy I was leaving behind. And then I'll flash forward for just a short paragraph. At the very end, I finally do make it out of the city in June on a Greyhound bus 6 months later. But now, on that bright June morning in 1968, when I finally made it out of the city in a Greyhound bus, it was the future that beckoned me, not the past. At the moment, I didn't know that, like my mother's psychiatrist, I was also bisexual, or that in 6 years Wesleyan University Press would publish my first collection containing the DePaul poems, or that I would spend so much of my life abroad, or that I would ever tell the story, one which for decades I tried to forget. I was 19 years old, trembling with the newness of myself, and the violent year that would brand my generation for a lifetime was opening before me through a bus windshield with all of its hidden promise and unforeseen consequences. As the Greyhound bus wheezed along Tulane Avenue, I shoved the vinyl valise containing my jeans and manuscripts under the seat, leaned back my head in relief, and yanked down the yellow window shade, vowing never again to set foot inside the city of New Orleans. If only for a moment, barreling toward the future in a cloud of diesel exhaust, I thought I heard the chimes of freedom flashing.
Then you were off. You were off.
I was off, and I really didn't look back for about 30 years, although I did visit.
You've seen so many changes in New Orleans, and I think so many people who've lived here a long time will recognize that. I mean, you are a diehard quarter rat who's finally moved away from the quarter.
Well, it's not a neighborhood anymore, as I was commenting, and I need to live in a New Orleans neighborhood. So I'm now back very close to the 7th Ward where I grew up in downtown New Orleans. And but yeah, the city has changed dramatically on the outside. It's unrecognizable to me on the outside, but it hasn't changed on the inside. It's still very much a city of neighborhoods, churches, tightly knit families. When you meet someone from New Orleans, a native of New Orleans, you just don't meet them. You meet their entire family.
Right.
They'll bring three cousins with them to the party. So a lot of the inside nature of New Orleans has not changed. And I'm a fifth generation native. My family came here from France in the 1850s and 60s. And very much the natives of the city, because we feel so overwhelmed by the onrush of mass tourism, and especially the post-Katrina disaster capitalism that has deluged us, we've very much closed our shutters to the outside world and live among ourselves.
And you did have one of the great Katrina escape stories in this book. You really did.
Yes, that was the – I was a diehard holdout, I think we were called, in the French Quarter. And it wasn't until my neighbor was dying of kidney failure because he was on dialysis and couldn't get it that we basically caught a stolen school bus and went to live at Andrei Kudrescu's house in Baton Rouge.
I love that story.
Until I got on a plane and flew to St. Petersburg. And then my friends in Barcelona rescued me, and they set up all these paid lectures I was supposed to give. And so basically I was away from the city for 3 months, not knowing if I'd be able to come home.